Support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Let There Be Love, a moving and comic drama about how an aging father and equally headstrong daughter find one another. Opens April 8th at the Geary Theater. ACT-SF.org.
Support for the California Report comes from Bayer, proud to be a Bay Area biotech pioneer for more than 30 years. Bayer, science for a better life. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
The hammer is about to come down on water wasters. The state is fine-tuning its plan to enforce water conservation. We'll visit a wealthy town in the heart of Silicon Valley that hasn't gotten with the program yet.
I don't know what the people at the high end are doing, but they have to also contribute to making the difference. We all need water. No one is more special than anyone else in needing water to survive.
What will it take to get the richest Californians to cut back their water use? Also, hard work, low pay, and lousy conditions. Welcome to the California Conservation Corps.
I had never done any kind of labor at all. You know, I grew up not going to school, sitting on the couch, you know, and then all of a sudden being told, dig this hole, move this there, and it really gave me what I always needed.
I'm Scott Schaefer. Sit back, settle in. It's the California Report. Brown lawns, dead trees, dwindling reservoirs. Reality is beginning to sink in, folks, isn't it? Even for those drought deniers hoping for a last-minute storm, it is time to face the music. The State Water Board is putting the final touches on plans to implement Governor Jerry Brown's demand to cut water use. So now comes the hard part, getting this plan to work on the ground. KQED science editor Craig Miller is here to get us started. And Craig, let's say, first of all, these regs are really very much a work in progress, right?
Boy, are they.
Really a work in progress.
There's a timeline. It's a fast-track timeline, but first they had to have a sort of general framework for it, which they put out. Now they're coming out with what they call a draft regulation. It'll be early May before we see a final version of this, and it'll probably be June or July before individual water districts actually have these, you know, implemented and working on the ground. And even Governor Brown, when he was standing on that barren mountainside, remember, on April 1st with no snow. Right. He knew it wasn't going to be easy, and he said as much.
And I can tell you, to utter the word ration is a lot quicker and clearer than actually implementing a strategy across the vast expanse of California.
So easier said than done, and I think we're already seeing that play out in the process.
Yeah, and speaking of the process, I'm sure that the Water Board is hearing from constituents, districts, and others. What are they hearing, and who are they hearing it from?
Well, I think to a great extent, they're hearing it from these 400 and some local water districts who are charged with actually putting this into place on the ground and enforcing it. Some of them are just trying to buy some time, frankly, saying, look, a month is not enough time to get a locally viable program up and in place on the ground.
That's probably fair.
Yeah. I mean, it can be. Yeah. And some of them, I think, are also quibbling a little bit with the math. You know, each area is being given a certain benchmark that they have to hit in terms of water saving, somewhere between 10% and 35%. And some are saying, hey, we don't think this one is fair.
Yeah. And so there must be concerns also, I would imagine, about the cost. I mean, when you talk about enforcing something, implementing something, that's people time, right?
Sure, yeah. Maybe you have to go out and hire some water cops. There's a public relations program you have to put in place. But, you know, it's not just the implementation, but it's this conundrum that water districts in California have always been in, where the more water you save, the less money they make. You know, it's not like electricity where they decoupled that. So a lot of people are saying, well, now may be the time for water districts to actually start restructuring their rates.
Yeah, because people say, hey, I'm saving water, and yet I'm paying more. I'm being penalized in a sense because the water districts aren't making as much money.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a real problem.
So once these plans are in place, how are they going to be enforced? Do you know?
Well, again, it's going to be up to the local district to kind of figure out how to do that. And some of them will use fines and some of them will use different types of, you know, gentle persuasion.
Carrots and sticks?
Yeah. A combination of carrots and sticks. That's right. But, you know, the real lever is between the state and the districts, because if they don't get their act together and start getting the job done, they can be fined $10,000 a day by the state. It'd be interesting to see how much that, to what extent that actually happens.
And so if you're in a place where people are just saying, screw it, I'm not going to save water, or they can't save water, whatever, it's not the individuals who get fined. It's the water district.
Yeah. Well, you know, water runs downhill, right? So does
when it rains.
We'll just say responsibility. So the state puts the pressure on the local district. The local district is going to have to come up with a way to keep a leash on you and me. It's going to be different. People keep asking us, how is it going to affect me? The answer is, we don't know yet. It depends on where you live and what your local district decides to structure in the way of a program.
And so, Craig, it could really be several months still, maybe even into rainy season before these final regulations are implemented.
All I can say is it better not take that long.
All right. KQED Science Editor Craig Miller. Craig, thanks a lot.
All right, Scott.
Well, it's really easy, isn't it, to see how this drought thing could turn into an ugly kind of us versus them scuffle. North versus South, the coast versus farms, and the 1% versus the rest of us. Backing that up, numbers from the State Water Board showing that in the swankiest zip codes in California, conservation isn't so chic. Cities like Beverly Hills and Malibu just aren't doing their part to save water. And neither is a wealthy rural town in the heart of Silicon Valley, Woodside.
I'm Jameis McNiven. I'm the founder and owner of Buck's of Woodside.
Buck's Restaurant is a favorite spot in a town whose residents include some of Silicon Valley's A-listers, like Oracle founder Larry Ellison and Charles Schwab. The place is quirky, not fancy. Cowboy hat lampshades, an alligator perched on a red wagon, that kind of thing. I asked Jameis McNiven how Buck's is dealing with the drought.
There's a lot of craziness around the water issue. It's been mandated that we don't ask our patrons if they want water. If they ask, we can serve it to them. Isn't the one thing we should do with water, drink it? Isn't everything else secondary? People say it raises consciousness. It just actually makes people unhappy.
Is there a community conversation happening, do you think, about water?
There really isn't much of a community conversation, but most of the lushness you see are the big trees that were growing here before the people came. So people don't have giant lawns generally here. It's not Beverly Hills by any means. It's very rural.
And I heard that kind of thing over and over in Woodside. Oh, we're not Beverly Hills. Or it's not us, it's farms that are wasting water. At a table in the corner, old-timer Joe Greenback admits he does have a big lawn.
I don't know whether we're going to have to let it go brown or not. We haven't yet, but we're thinking of those terms and how we can conserve or cut back. So, yeah, we're doing what we can, but we've got a large investment in landscaping that I don't want to lose either.
Could you imagine it getting to the point where you tear out the lawn and put in whatever, something that's drought resistant?
Well, it'd have to get a lot more serious than it is now.
The drought is serious, but Woodside isn't really doing much conservation. According to the state, Woodside has cut water use just 4% in the past 2 years. So they're about to pay the price for that. Under the new state regulations, Woodside must reduce water use by 35%, or its water district could be fined $10,000 every day it's out of compliance.
I'm constantly looking for something that looks lush, that doesn't require a lot of water.
That's Judy Sieber. She owns a home and garden store here. Sieber says she took a can of green spray paint to some dead plants that lined her driveway at home. Her customers are thinking about the drought, she says, although she wonders how many are actually doing something about it.
People are talking about veganism. They're talking about golf courses. They're talking about dead lawns. You know, there's a lot of dinner party talk.
Does it get heated, really?
Oh, absolutely. There's some people that are like, I don't care. It's water. These aren't my friends. But
Sieber says it's going to take everybody in this community to make change.
Absolutely. I think everybody needs to do their part. This is my motto. Just because you can, you know, have all of this, just because you can doesn't mean you should, you know. Just because you can afford to have a rolling golf course in your backyard, I'm probably offending people I know, but it doesn't mean, you know, it's a different time.
And Sieber thinks there could be tension and resentment toward richer communities if they're seen as ignoring pleas to save water. But Woodside has a water watchdog to make sure that doesn't happen. Debbie Mendelson went to a town council meeting last July, armed with a 3-ring notebook full of data on water waste. Her message, get with the program and adopt a water conservation plan already.
So I don't know what the people at the high end are doing, but they have to also contribute to making the difference. We all need water. No one is more special than anyone else in needing water to survive.
Mendelson lives next to a private golf course, and she fumes every time she sees them watering their plush green fairways in the middle of the day with drinkable water. In fact, water seems to be a family obsession. Her son Jason chairs the town's conservation committee.
We're going to be in real trouble, and this is sort of the last chance, and I applaud all the cities and all the municipal water districts that are doing what they can do to make a change. But I think it's time that those of us who are maybe of means take a leadership role in making the changes, both culturally and practically, so that we can have some water in the future.
It's been more than 8 months since the Mendelsons urged the town to adopt a water conservation plan. Woodside is still thinking about it. Okay, so how's this for a job recruiting message? Hard work, low pay, miserable conditions, and more. Well, that is actually the motto for the California Conservation Corps. They put young adults to work outdoors, and in Marin County, their job is building and maintaining world-class trails. And for the series California Foodways, Lisa Morehouse describes the role food plays for a crew of young folks burning thousands of calories a day, and why the menu has barely changed since the 1930s.
Hold it. You got it?
Yeah.
There it is.
20-year-old Willie Parker shows me the huge drainage area. He and his crew are shoring up on a trail outside Devil's Gulch Camp.
It should last like a couple of hundred years, a long time. I think that's pretty awesome.
Watch your foot, watch your hands.
California Conservation Corps members, CEs for short, roll rocks as heavy as 500 pounds into place and chisel them for a snug fit. That's all to support the tens of thousands of hikers, mountain bikers, and horseback riders that'll use this trail.
Over the time, the dirt, the leaves will fall over it to make it look natural.
Parker's got a broad smile and hair peeking out from under his blue hard hat. Corps members earn minimum wage and spend 8 days working, then 6 days back at a residential center near Lake Tahoe, where they get time off and take classes. Like Parker, many work on their GEDs. Two C's have left the trail work early.
I already seasoned it.
You can start cutting the lemons and the oranges.
Samantha Pack and Gabina Lopez are on KP duty tonight.
KP stands for Kitchen Patrol, or Kitchen Police, as we call it. It's the person whose duty it is to take care of the kitchen and camp.
The kitchen's really clean, but it's not much to look at.
It's basically just an old burlap tent. It's set up with our two stoves, two chests that are filled with our pots and our pans, plates, dishes. It's a tight space.
This is the onion for the fish. In my mind, I think it's going to taste good.
They're feeding a crew of 20. Plus a couple supervisors.
For us KPs, we try to make something delicious just to make the crew feel like they're at their house.
Each year, California Conservation Corps hires about 3,000 men and women between 18 and 25. Each C has his or her own reasons for joining, but many here, like Samantha Pack, told me they needed some direction.
I was very defiant. I was taught to always run from my problems, and that's what I did. And so when I started to realize that running wasn't getting things done, it finally clicked and my mentality changed.
The Bakersfield native found she really loves trail work.
I had never done any kind of labor at all. You know, I grew up not going to school, sitting on the couch, you know, and then all of a sudden being told, dig this hole, move this there, and it really gave me what I always needed. You know, that not only that discipline, but having an urgency to get things done the right way.
It's like we're a big machine as a group, and the KPs are the batteries to the machine.
Lopez pulls out the 8-day food calendar, labeled for breakfast and dinner.
Today we're having fish fillet, rice pilaf, carrots, and salad. And day 4, which would be Saturday, we're having pork chops, red potatoes, broccoli, and salad.
Victor Belayets flips through pages in a binder in his office on Mount Tamalpais. He oversees maintenance of state parks in Marin.
I'm looking at old food orders, and this was a group of Civilian Conservation Corps that were working at Mount Tamalpais, and this one is from 1939.
And guess what? It sounds a lot like what the KP crew is making tonight.
For supper, there was filet of sole, there were mashed potatoes, creamed carrots, bread, butter, coffee.
The similarities in the menu aren't sentimental. Camp food has always had to fuel large groups for hard labor. Founded in 1933 as a New Deal effort, the Civilian Conservation Corps employed millions of young men, many of them veterans, to work in remote government-owned land, planting trees, building roadways, updating parks. In Marin, they built trails and camps and a beautiful amphitheater, still in use today. The Corps only accepted men, and the crews were segregated by race.
It seems inconceivable today when you look at the mix of California Conservation Corps,
which is about a quarter women and very diverse. But Beliot says what the two have in common is young people doing important work as a group for the public good.
Part of that culture that's built around a camp gets built around males.
Back at camp, as his fellow Corps members start to come off the trail, Gabino Lopez tends the fire.
I'd honestly rather sit in the fire and watch it for like 3 hours than sit at home in a couch and just watch TV, I think so. I'd rather bathe in the creek than shower in the bathroom. I don't know, it just makes me feel more alive, I think.
Coming in hot.
And he's happy, pan-frying fish and sautéing carrots. Willie Parker says after working all day and hiking down, KP is a lifesaver.
Just get to camp, and the food's just smelling good, and, you know, everybody just be walking around the KP tent ready to eat, so it's pretty good. We got that right there.
Hey, so everyone here, wash up.
Like a lot of this crew, Parker didn't camp or fish as a kid.
Camping, it's amazing, you know? It's amazing, but like, yeah, I haven't done none of that until I joined the CCC.
Yeah, we have hot water.
But it's not just about trying new things. Parker has a 2-year-old daughter at home in Sacramento.
I can bring my daughter up here when she gets older to understand and be like, I built this, you know? It opens my heart and my mind, like, I can do something I never thought I can do, you know? Like, I see trails, and I used to wonder, like, oh, I wonder how you built this or who built it, you know? And now it's like I find myself actually answering my own question.
And finding purpose and pride in this work. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Marin County.
Lisa Morehouse produced that story while at Hedgebrook. That's a residency for women writers. That is the second movement of a piano concerto in D major by Mozart. It's being played live, but there is no pianist in the room. That's because it's a player piano. The music was recorded on long paper rolls more than 100 years ago. And as Cindy Abanu reports, Stanford University just got its hands on a collection of rolls and pianos that will come to life at a special concert this weekend.
So the roll has been placed on the take-up spool, and then we're going to click the play button, put this on.
That's Kumar Narul, a music instructor at Stanford. He's led the effort to acquire and preserve more than 7,500 rolls and 10-player pianos from a collector in Australia. Each piano plays music recorded on perforated rolls.
It was capable of reproducing the nuances of touch and timing of a pianist who recorded in real time.
It became popular in the late 19th and early 20th centuries and then died out as the phonograph improved. The rolls at Stanford occupy rows and rows of shelves in the basement of the music library. They include recordings by greats like Gershwin and Stravinsky. And this 1905 recording by Teresa Carreño, a pioneering female pianist playing the Hungarian Rhapsody No. 6 by Franz Liszt. This Beethoven piece was recorded by Karl Reinecke.
He was born in 1824. He's one of the oldest people we have. any recording of. He lived during the time Beethoven and Schubert were still alive, and he plays in a way that is really astonishing.
Stanford students are using the piano rolls to look for clues. Senior Nayanthara Jain studied renditions of a piano sonata by Chopin. Here she is, actually playing it herself.
It's really liberating as a student to hear what these composers and performers were doing and all the kinds of parameters they could work with.
Jane says the pianists on the old rolls had less of a dogmatic approach. They were more willing to be flexible with rhythm and tempo changes.
These actual composers playing their own pieces do things that teachers will tell you are not okay. And so it just opens up a whole world of expressive possibility, and that's really exciting.
The Stanford Symphony rehearses with a player piano for its upcoming concert this weekend. The keys move up and down, playing a role recorded by Percy Grainger in 1921. For the concert, Stanford has flown in player piano expert Rex Lawson from London. He'll play a foot-operated version, manipulating the roll as the piano reads it.
I can remember a concert pianist, I won't name him, when I did a concert at the end of the 1970s, as I was about to go on stage, said, "Gee, enjoy yourself with your musical toy," he said. And these things are not toys. They are serious musical instruments, and it's jolly good, finally, that people are beginning to take them seriously.
Soon the rolls will be available to musicians beyond the Stanford community. Researchers there are designing a custom scanner that will digitize the rolls and make them available online. For the California Report, I'm Cynthia Banu in Palo Alto.
And finally today, you might just be making plans for summer vacation, maybe somewhere far away. And the thing you're probably looking forward to the least is getting there, right? No, flying is not fun. Crying babies, cramped seats, and they charge for everything these days, even pillows and blankets. But at one point, a few decades ago, people actually got excited to fly. They even dressed up for it. From KCRW in Los Angeles, Steve Chiotegas visited a place trying to recreate that experience.
On a recent Saturday night, I drove to a suburb north of Los Angeles to fly in luxury without ever actually leaving the ground.
On behalf of myself and the entire crew, we would like to welcome you on board this Pan Am 747 Jet Clipper. As we prepare for departure...
This is the Pan Am experience, where you can shell out $300 or more to get a taste of what you may have seen or felt on a Pan Am flight decades ago. I'm on board a rebuilt 747 parked in an industrial-looking warehouse with a couple dozen other passengers who are just as nostalgic.
We're flight attendants.
Josh DeFelice and Brent Casper live in West Hollywood and came to see what flying used to be like.
When it was actually glamorous.
The meals and the white gloves and so... It looks like they did a great job. Everything looks really amazing.
Passengers were different. You see tonight, everyone's here dressed up, looking nice, looking natty, looking like they're going to travel around the world.
Barbara Norberg was a Pan Am stewardess from 1970 until the company went out of business in 1991. Now, she trains the actors who were flight attendants here. She says flying is a lot different today.
Now you get on the airplane and people barely dress, let alone dress up. So it's a kind of a different atmosphere on airplanes. It's a bus with wings.
Not this plane, though. There's first class and coach seating, a staircase to an upper deck lounge, a cockpit, and a crew decked out in 1970s Pan Am regalia, including Roger Garcia and Holly Gray.
We're
we're flying all over the world, so every day is new.
Plus, it's different every night. You meet new people with interesting jobs, people that have worked in the airline industry before, and you get to hear wonderful memories.
The velvet blue and red seats, the passenger information cards, even the glasses and the silverware. It's all vintage Pan Am. And, of course, there's the food.
A plate with caprese, or you can get shrimp.
Wow.
And then we serve either pasta, or we have the meat with the Chateaubriand sauce, or the chicken. And then we have a plate of fruit and cheese, and then we serve the cake.
And all of that for everyone on board. Our flight attendant actually carves a roast on a rolling cart. That's how it was done on board a flight decades ago. This plane and everything on it was put together by one man, Anthony Toth. He began piloting his passion when he was a little boy.
I started collecting airplane models and small things like timetables and luggage tags. But as I got older, the desire to have more and more aircraft things became greater and greater.
So much so that Toth visited so-called airport graveyards in the deserts that sold larger pieces of fuselage.
Sidewall panels and overhead bins and, you know, galley modules and seats. And as I became a young adult, no matter where I lived, I always had a small aircraft mock-up in my house. And, you know, fast forward about 20 years later, this is what happens.
What happens is couples dress up. They drink cocktails and relish in a recreation of Pan Am that feels so authentic. Even the former flight attendant, Barbara Norberg, says she couldn't believe it.
I walked in the first class door there, and I just, tears came to my eyes because it was so real. It was so well done. It was really amazing. Now I'm over that because I just enjoy watching people have a good time.
Flying high, getting a glimpse, even if for an evening, of what it was like up there way back when. For the California Report, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm Kim Shattuck from a band called The Muffs, and I'm in Silver Lake, California. That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. I think I got that right. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. That's right, baby. The online team includes David Weir, David Marks, Lisa Hickoff-White, and Olivia Allen Price. Our interns are Michelle Dutro and Pyle Zuveri. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malian, Taiki Hendricks, Ingrid Becker, and Holly Kernan. I'm Kim Shattuck, and thanks for listening.
This is the California Report.
California Foodways is made possible with support from Cal Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Visit www.calhum.org. Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, with nomination information about the 2016 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards, available at irvine.org. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.